On a Tuesday, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about public schools with the Deputy State Superintendent. We'll look at the achievement gap and new test scores, mental health services in schools, and what to do about teen vaping, which is now elevated to a crisis situation. Wisconsin school groups want the legislature to act on two bills. So what issues are pressing in your district, in your school? What do you want the state to act on to improve the quality of public education across the board? We're at 800-642-1234. Mike Thompson is Deputy State Superintendent of the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, and he's served in this position for the past decade. He was appointed when then-Superintendent Tony Evers took office in 2009. Deputy Superintendent Mike Thompson, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So DPI, Department of Public Instruction, released student test scores from last year. Just last week, it showed that less than half of Wisconsin students were proficient in reading and math last school year. What can we attribute this to? Why aren't these numbers budging at all?
Well, you see, if you saw from those test scores, we did have a slight decrease in English, language arts, and mathematics. And just to get a little context, our exams, our forward exam, which we call them, is 3 through 8 testing in English, language arts, and mathematics in grades 4 and 8, and in science in grades 4, 8, and 10. In 4 and 8 in science and 4, 8, and 10 in social studies. And it is a comprehensive statewide assessment designed to provide information about what students know in core academic areas. It doesn't measure everything that goes on in a school, as we know, but it gives a knowledge indicator. And we have seen just a slight decrease in those particular areas. Some good news in some areas where mathematics scores went up slightly around those particular pieces, but those scores have been relatively stagnant over the last several years around those particular core subject areas.
So if they are, it seems, kind of stagnant, as you say, you know, what can be done about that? You know, what is going on here that student test scores just aren't improving?
Well, I think several things are going on. I think every year when we do this assessment, it gives us a good indicator where kids are at, and it gives a good idea talking about where we need to go around in education. But we have to remember, we have a state where, you know, we're educating all our children. Every kid in this state is eligible for free public education 4 through age 20. And we have our student population has some challenges. We have increase in poverty in our particular state. It's practically doubled over the last particular decade, from 21% a decade ago to like around 49% or 47 to 49% today. More than half our school districts have children living in poverty in their particular districts. We have a homeless rate in our state that has just skyrocketed over the years. So there are a number of challenges in our state about the kids that are coming into our particular schools. And school districts are striving each and every single day to get all those kids to achieve. And I think when we have test scores like this, when we roll these test scores out, it really provides an opportunity for us to use these scores to look at what is going on in schools with a flashlight. Sometimes what happens is we use these test scores as a hammer. We must change. We must do something differently. And quite frankly, we have to use them as a flashlight to be able to look at the system, to look at how we modify the system to change what we're providing for children, for all kids can achieve. Mm-hmm. It's a long-term process.
Yeah, we heard about the analogy of the flashlight last week when we were looking at these scores. Let's look at what's going on in the achievement gap. Test scores still significantly different between African-American and white students. What could the department be doing to help schools address these achievement gaps?
Yeah, there are several approaches to addressing the achievement gap. And the achievement gap is not something new. We didn't discover the achievement gap today. It's a long-term approach to really modify our education system. So it's a system that works for all kids. And clearly, the education system does not work for all kids at all times, and we need to change that. For children of color, we clearly have to diversify our workforce so they see people like themselves into our school system. If our student population right now, our student population is about 30% of color, Our adult population is about 19% of color. Our teachers teaching in our school districts is certainly in single digits. So we have to be able to make schools places where all kids feel welcome. That's one thing we can start to do to diversify the workforce. That's a long-term commitment. That is not going to happen overnight. There are several other things we can do in school districts that school districts are working on. They're working on creating relationships with kids, a key to making kids feel that they're connected to school, that they belong there, that is someplace they should be. It's really difficult to teach kids when they don't come to school, so we have to make sure kids want to be in school, feel that it's a place they want to be. And districts are doing several strategies around making schools that way for all kids.
Talking with Mike Thompson, he is Deputy State Superintendent of the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. You can join in. What do you want to ask the Deputy State Superintendent about test scores, about student mental health, about his department's priorities? What policies do you think would help boost schools' scores or on standardized tests? How do you want to see schools responding to declining test scores? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. This year, state lawmakers approved a $500 million increase in spending for schools, almost $100 million in new dollars for special education costs. Does DPI plan on using that funding to boost student performance? How do those dollars get put to work?
Okay, absolutely. The budget was a step in the right direction. The budget was an equity budget that really looked at some of the challenges schools are facing and trying to address those challenges. As you mentioned, the area of special education is actually about $97 million. I'll take another $3 million if you have it.
Increase. We round up. All right, carry
on. Over the biennium. This is really the first increase in special education funding in over a decade. And when you talk about that increase in special education funding, it went from about 25% reimbursement for the services provided to kids to 30%, so a nickel on the dollar. Those are services that school districts are required to provide under federal and state law for kids, and those costs have increasingly gone up over the years. So when costs go up in the area of special education, the amount of money districts have for general programming goes down unless the state or the state picks up part of that. So this is a step in the right direction.
Oh, so the schools have been absorbing those extra costs.
Absolutely, those costs. And those are necessary costs and the right thing to do for our special needs kids. But it comes from the general education fund, which is what makes schooling a good place for all kids. And when you start pulling from one to serve others, you really diminish the ability of schools to meet some of the other needs that are going on. It's just they're not able to do it. This was a huge need area in our particular state. The $97 million is significant because districts will use those costs to help to be able to provide programming and opportunities for kids across the system while still meeting the needs of special education kids. And when you talk about those dollars going into the general fund to provide service to all kids, those include special education kids as well. So everybody benefits from it, in my opinion, when you increase the cost of mandated services and when you increase payment and reimbursement for special education costs.
And will there be any expansion of special education services with those additional dollars?
Special education services are mandated that you provide those services based on the needs of kids. Those services are already provided. So there won't be an expansion of special education services because those services are already provided, but there will be more opportunities for services for students across the system, which does include special education kids. They benefit from what goes on in the classroom just like all kids do. So more fund in the general pot for schools is better for all students. It allows them to provide additional opportunities for kids, additional services, additional staff, additional after-school program, whatever school districts feel they need to help all kids achieve. They are able to use those funds to do those things.
Talking with Deputy State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Mike Thompson, what do you want to ask him about test scores, about student mental health, about special education? How do you hope to see the department addressing anxiety and depression among students at school? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Mm-hmm. You have a line to the Deputy State Superintendent on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, thanks for being here. We're talking about public education issues, including mental health. How do you hope to see the Department of Public Instruction addressing anxiety, addressing depression among students? What mental health challenges is your district responding to right now? Your questions, your situation, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Mike Thompson is Deputy State Superintendent, and he stays with us for the conversation. Let's go to the phones now. Carissa is joining us from Green Bay. Good morning, Carissa.
Good morning. My question is if there's any correlation that they've noticed between the change in the way that students receive grades on their report card and these test scores. So, for example, my nephew is in the third grade in a public school in Green Bay, and they don't receive A, B, C scale anymore. They receive has improved, needs improvement type feedback.
Carissa, thanks for the call. What about that? This transition, again, you know, from the ABCs and now into this has improved and needs improved area?
Well, that's a great question, Carissa. And it really tells us about what different types of assessments school districts give and what they use grading for. And if you compare that to a statewide summit of assessment, they really, quite frankly, serve different purposes. And so when you look at how school district grades, it's grading on more than likely just content knowledge. It's very likely grading on the skills and habits that they're also trying to impart into kids that are really part of what's necessary to help kids become career and college ready. So the correlation, there may or may not be a correlation between how those kids perform within a grade and how they perform on assessments. That's why they serve two different purposes. But your school district, Green Bay, and other school districts as well, provide different types of assessment all through the year so parents can see where their child are at, where they're at as far as terms of grade level. Arguably, you would see for an individual student a correlation between how they're achieving within the classroom and how they're achieving on a statewide assessment. You would very likely over time see that correlation. But we have to remember it's kids' lives and the education arena are developmental. And so we're getting kids to become career and college ready. We test at certain grade levels, but not all kids developmentally are ready for that mark. And so we have to give kids time to reach that mark. So everybody's developmental. Assessments that school districts provide during the school year help teachers see how quickly and how closely people are to those particular benchmarks. And then the state does a benchmark assessment.
Are we seeing letter grades in high schools, or do we see these groupings of words, these benchmarks?
We see letter grades in high schools and grade point averages in high school, but we see a lot of different ways that people are looking at how to use grading as an accurate reflection of what students know, the skill, as I mentioned before, the knowledge, skills, and habits of what they're trying to accomplish. Most of the time, those particular assessments are aligned to the standards that guide instruction. And so we're teaching, more importantly, and grading towards the standards and not necessarily teaching towards the test.
Let's bring in Susan now, joining us from Nina. Hi, Susan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I'm calling about dyslexia. So since 1976, the National Institutes of Health have been studying dyslexia. And we have states like Arkansas that have taken a more aggressive approach on addressing dyslexia, addressing their literacy, their reading instruction, and changing it, and are bypassing us far. Wisconsin is one of the states in the Midwest that isn't addressing anything with dyslexia. We're working on some legislation right now, but we are very far behind on literacy due to the fact that we continue to say this is the way to do it, but we're not producing the results. And when you're not producing the results, you change the way you do things. So why aren't we doing something in Wisconsin? Why isn't CPI
Susan,
taking
thank
standard
you.
C?
Let's get a response here. Mike Thompson, what do we know as to how DPI is working with dyslexia and where we're at?
Yeah. In the last budget, there was a provision in the budget that the Department of Public Instruction would put out a guidebook that's helpful in addressing kids with dyslexia and that particular issue in the accomplishment of reading. And reading is as we all, and you mentioned this, Susan, is really the kind of the foundation of our education system. We need to get kids all be able to read, to enter school with the foundations for reading, and then to be able to progress in reading. And that includes looking at all the reasons why kids can't read. And there's as you know, Susan, there are a lot of debates around the approaches to reading, around those particular pieces. I think sometimes those debates are healthy around looking at what is it that kids need, because it all eventually boils down to the individual student. As you know, we have kids that come to school that literally have been read 1,000 books. 100 of those, or 200, or maybe 1,000 of those books were read to the child when they were in the womb, and they've been read thousands of books before they come into school. And other students don't have that opportunity. And when they enter the school system can take some kids that already have an established love of literacy and build on that love of literacy. And other students, they have to develop that love of literacy. And then they have to be able to assess where those students are at and help them over their specific challenges that they may have. And that includes dyslexia. It's not ignoring that as a particular issue, but looking at that as how do we address that particular issue and helping that individual child progress in reading like every other child should have that opportunity to do. So dyslexia is an issue that a lot of kids face. We will have some guidance around how you address dyslexia, but there always will be a debate around the most effective reading strategy. I believe personally that debate is good because all kids are not the same.
Talking with Mike Thompson, Deputy State Superintendent of the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, your thoughts on public education in the state, your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's touch on mental health for a moment. DPI during the summer was awarded $6.5 million in grants to help schools with mental health services. Will this money be used in a one-size-fits-all approach, or do schools have some latitude with how they use the funding for mental health?
No, schools will have some latitude. This was a very important piece of the governor's budget proposal. It doubled the amount of money that was available for mental health aid, and it's a very critical piece that school districts need. I've had many principals tell me, if you give me a dollar, I'll spend 90% of that on mental health needs of kids. The mental health aid is very important. It allows school districts to collaborate with community partners to provide services to kids. It allows for school districts to train staff to recognize mental health issues in kids. It really acknowledges that this is a challenge that some kids come to school with, and schools play a role in addressing that. This allocation within the budget, the grants that we just provided to school districts, we believe will allow, and over the next year, about 120,000 kids to get access to mental health services that they would not have been able to get access to without this funding.
Let's talk about vaping for a moment. Three Wisconsin school groups are calling on lawmakers to help curb teen vaping. It's been called a crisis with teens. There is legislation with the minimum sales age for tobacco products, moving that to 21, current age is 18. What role do you see DPI playing in this call to address teen vaping?
Yeah, vaping is a crisis, and clearly we need to get vaping out of our school districts, and DPI as an agency can advocate to some of those particular positions in passing policy and laws that do that. Most importantly, schools are on the education business, and being able to educate kids about the dangers of vaping, what we're discovering about vaping, is really important. And school districts have done a good job over the years in talking about alcohol and other drug abuses in schools, and there's been funding from the state legislature to support that. We have seen over the years a huge decline in currently with the amount of kids using illicit drugs and alcohol consumption. We can do the same thing with vaping. We've done it with smoking. It is something that we have to tackle both through legislation that prohibits the use of vaping, but then education around the dangers of vaping, and that happens in a school district.
What are school districts doing on this front? Is it too new? Is the material ready? What are they telling students?
I don't think it's too new. I think we have discovered some more research around vaping. It is interesting. It kind of the way that vaping over the last several years has just kind of evolved around what's going on in schools and people using it in schools and devices that can be quite frankly hidden quite easily in schools. I think there's a general awareness now with the research around vaping that we need to tackle this head on. And I think school districts are starting to do that with policies and also through an education program.
Very quickly, State Superintendent Carolyn Stanford Taylor will give her annual State of Education address Thursday. What can we expect to learn from her address?
I think you'll find from State Superintendent Taylor, she has a very strong equity belief. And an equity belief is we need to give all kids what they need when they need it. I think you'll see that come through in her speech. That I think you'll also find that she has some very specific strategies around how to address the equity issues in our state, including student continuing on this drive to provide more resources for kids in school districts that need them. This is starting to work for the next biennial budget. This last biennial budget was a step in the right direction. We're not all the way there. She will advocate for more resources for school districts. She'll add for specific programming around school districts to really address the needs of all kids so what all kids can achieve.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Mike Thompson is Deputy State Superintendent of the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Coming up, we're learning more about plant-based meat and how these products are processed. We'll learn why meat alternatives are growing in popularity. Do you enjoy plant-based meat, or are you someone who doesn't buy plant-based meat products? Why is that? Join in at 800-642-1234. Stay with us. News is up next on the Ideas Network. We're talking about fake meat on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Large companies like grocery chain Kroger and food processor Tyson are following in the footsteps of some fast food chains like Burger King offering meat alternatives. Kroger is trying out a dedicated plant-based protein section that is in its meat aisle this fall at dozens of stores. Tyson Foods is embracing plant-based shellfish. It's the world's second largest processor and marketer of chicken, beef, and pork. Tyson announced earlier this month it will debut faux shrimp next year. So have you tried plant-based meat products? What have you eaten? How does the taste compare to actual meat? We're at 800-642-1234. Prana Bendu Mitra is an assistant professor in the Department of Food and Nutrition at UW-Stout, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Prana Bendu, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Okay, thank you. Good morning.
So help us understand what ingredients are found in plant-based meat products. What's in them?
Okay, so if you look at the meat products, so basically we are familiar with the meat for animal source. But when you go for the alternative or animal source, that means we are having that protein from the plant sources. For example, soybean. And other plant sources and potato protein, wheat protein. So in company, different company like Impossible Burger, they are producing that plant protein-based burger. What they are doing, they are mixing the wheat protein, potato protein, and soy protein. And they are also like in animal protein, they are the one kind of iron is there. It's called heme iron.
Mm-hmm.
But in plant protein, is a lack of heme iron. So they are extracting heme iron from soybean plant and also presently now from yeast. So they are mixing that things together and put in that extruder.
And so in an extruder. And so yeah. you're mixing and really combining these plant-based ingredients.
Yeah. Like soy protein and wheat protein, potato protein, including that they're also using coconut oil.
Uh-huh.
And they're mixing all together as a powder form and putting to that extruder. And then they are adding water. So in that process, they are extruding with a high moisture. Moisture is about more than 50%. So they are extruding with that about 130 to 180 degrees centigrade temperature. And when it comes through that extruder and coming through a orifice, a small hole is called orifice, and that time they are maintaining in less than 100 degrees centigrade. So this way what happened that texturized protein, a protein analog, they're having there. So that means that your fiber content in protein, and protein fiber, and with water, they're making three-dimensional gel, and that protein are texturized.
Well, this is high tech. This is really high tech. You mentioned earlier the Impossible Burger. What is the Impossible Burger?
So that is the Impossible Burger. They're using that ingredients. So in ingredients, and so also they are using the heme iron. So that they same, they are using the same technology, that extrusion technology with the high moisture extrusion technology. So in this process, there when it's texturized and it comes out as a texturized protein. But if you like to make it that meat analog, like beef analog, so that time they are also using some fruits or vegetable extracts, for example, carrot extracts or apple extracts, or different kinds of seasons, so that it will be like a color and texture-wise, it's like if it's a beef, but it's not beef. It's a completely a plant protein base.
So they're using all the senses in the texture, in the taste, in the smell to really mimic.
Mimic to that original meat analog.
So are plant-based meat products, are they healthier than eating actual cuts of meat, lean cuts of meat?
Okay. So now you see that when healthier, what we need to understand. So first we need to understand that what is meat actually. So meat is that polymer of amino acid. So in that amino acid is the smallest version molecule is called amino acid. And one amino acid is attached with other amino acid is a peptide bond. And then when you are making one after another, and it's a long chain of amino acid. This is the meat, whatever beef you are having here, or if you see. But when we have this one, during the digestion process, they actually break down in their original molecule, like amino acid. So we need around 20 different types of amino acid in our body, maintaining sustainability for our muscle tissue. So within this 22 amino acid, 9 are called essential amino acid. So why they are calling essential amino acid? Because our body cannot synthesize that 9 different kinds of amino acid. On the other hand, other words, I can tell that our body cannot produce that amino acid, that is called essential amino acid. So now, in a plant protein, what happened, you can see that so many of the plant proteins, they are lack of one or two essential amino acids. That's why they are called incomplete protein compared to the meat.
Yeah,
but you see that if you, some good news is that, like soybean, quinoa, buckwheat, they are complete protein because they are having all 9 different amino acids in that. So now is a plant protein. When you mix into it, that's why now it's the different companies like Impossible Burger. I'm telling that there is a wheat protein. They are using potato protein. They are using some soy protein. So when you're mixing together, so basically you are getting all kinds of essential, 9 different kinds of essential amino acid, what you need for your body.
So lots of chemistry going on here. We're talking about fake meat with Prana Bendu Mitra. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Food and Nutrition at UW-Stout. You can join in on these faux meat products. Are you on a plant-based diet? Have you found any challenges with that? How has it impacted your lifestyle? Has it helped your health? What do you think about the taste of these faux meat burgers? Have you tried an Impossible Burger? What do you think? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Owen now, joining us from Weawega. Hi, Owen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
One of my concerns with these kind of products is we grow whole foods in our garden. We don't use pesticides or chemicals to do that. We're not certified organic, but if you're buying something as a consumer and it's not labeled that it's been grown using organic practices, the exposure to chemicals, including commercial fertilizers, is very high with any type of commercial produce. So we need to be aware of that, even though it's been processed and it's gone through an extremely complex processing procedure. I think that's something else you need to be concerned about as well, because when you're taking something from its original form and then turning it into something different, we don't know what the long-term effects of that is in our body. In a way, look at what's been happening with wheat and potential contrast between irritable bowel syndrome and things like that as a result of commercial-grown wheat.
Owen, thanks for the call. What do we know there as these basic plants then get processed through all this chemistry, Pranab Indu, and come out on the other end?
So now you see that when you have the plant protein, now, yes, there is a concern that if you are not having meat for the longer time, so what will be your health? So one thing I can say that if you're having the plant protein, so what is the difference? So now you see that if you're having the your high meat consumption, if you are increasing meat consumption, so you are having high cholesterol and then also high unsaturated fat, fatty acid. So that is actually bad for your health. So on the other hand, in the plant protein, if you are looking for there, so they are lack of vitamin B12, but they are having a lot of phytonutrients, antioxidants, and that is good for your health. And there will be no issue of the cholesterol. So now, for the long-term history, you can see that recently a journal is called JMA, Internal Medicine. Mm-hmm. They published one paper in the Japanese research group. And they studied about more than 70,000 adults, people, and on an average 18 years. And they look for that when you have only that plant-based protein or plant-based food, and then they compare with that meat-based food. So now they got that, and they published result that your longevity will be the way higher than compared to when you are having meat. And also you are able to reduce the risk of diabetes, cardiovascular disease.
Diabetes and cardiovascular
and
health. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is actually proved. Is that when more than 70,000 people or adults were involved in the studies and 18 years. So it shows that if you are having your protein, plant protein for the longer time, that's not actually bad. It's actually good for your health, and you will be able to reduce that kind of problems, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, obesity.
Do we see, Pranab Indu, health being the reason why there is this trend going on? People are eating these plant-based meats. This is not the veggie burgers of yesteryear going on here. What's attributed to this trend?
So why this is trend? Now we see that. So if we are really healthy, so there is no need that you need to change your food habit, right? But not look at here that U.S. health. Just consider U.S. health. About 2/3 of adults are overweight. And 1/3 of them are obese.
Obese.
And about 50% of adults in U.S. are about to the pre-diabetes or diabetes 2, like this. And day by day, it's alarmingly increasing your heart disease, stroke, and that kind of problems. Why is it happening?
Yeah, let's pause right there with the cause. Pranab Indu Mitra is our guide. He teaches in the UW Stout Department of Food and Nutrition. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at this growing trend as meat eaters try more plant-based alternatives and the market responds. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. Traditionally, vegan and vegetarian items have been sold far away from the meat aisle, but that's changing. The fake meat market will grow to an almost $23 billion industry in coming years. And we're seeing big food companies like Hormel, like Tyson, Kellogg's, a few names planning to offer faux meat products at grocery stores. So are you on a plant-based diet? Have you found any challenges? How has it impacted your life? Have you tried plant-based meat products? What about the Impossible Burger? What do you think of the taste? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Pranabendu Mitra is our guide. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Food and Nutrition at UW-Stout. Let's go to the phones now. Caesar is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Caesar.
Hi, good morning. I'm glad this topic has come up because I've been plant-based for like 9 months now. And my challenge is not finding the food or getting the right amount of nutrients. It's getting other people to kind of want to try this because I have a lot of meathead friends and they need something to look and taste like cow in order for them to want to consume it. And you tell them it's got no cow, like the Impossible Burger, and they're very reluctant to try it. Or try any other sort of faux meat. I try not to do so many of these highly processed meats, but it's a good way to get other people to try it. They see you trying it, you bring extra, and you try and share it.
Yeah.
Some are brave enough to try it and end up liking it. It's just getting through their head, you know, try it.
Caesar, how has this 9 months gone for you? Will you stick with this?
I think I will because I've lost weight, not even trying. I'm eating a whole lot more, a lot more variety, a lot more kinds of legumes, fruits, veggies, and tofu. And now I go to Burger King rarely, but ever since they came out with their Impossible Whopper, which is not terrible, or other restaurant chains that are putting in the Impossible or the Beyond Burger, it's easier to find. You're not like in a food desert for vegans anymore. It's really good.
You're finding more choices out there. Caesar, thank you so much for your situation. Pranabendu, it sounds like there are more options out there.
Yeah. So now we see that if you are looking for their plant food, based food, so not only just meat analog, so we need for our body what we need. We need carbohydrate, we need protein, we need lipid, we need vitamins, we need minerals, right? So that in this sense, if you think about that, that what we need, so we need to make a balance. Like Caesar told that he also lost some weight. So, and also he is having legumes. So four different of plant source food, you can four or five different source. For example, you can go for grains. So grains like all kinds of brown rice and wheat flour, millet, and oatmeal. So you can get a lot of carbohydrate base. And then you can fruits and vegetables, fruits, different varieties of different color, different sizes of fruits you can have. And then you have vegetables, starchy to non-starchy tubers, for example, potato, and carrots, parsnip, too, your kale, spinach. So we can get a lot of varieties of food and legumes. So soybeans, all kinds of beans, lentils, pulses. So we can get all kinds of sorts of your protein, whatever you need.
Yeah, it sounds like there is a wide range out including nuts as well. Let's bring in Brittany now in Eau Claire. Hi, Brittany.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Being on a plant-based diet for about 6.5 years now has completely changed my life. I have better skin, I've lost a bunch of weight, and my stomach doesn't hurt anymore. I think I was probably lactose intolerant, and living in Wisconsin, cheese and milk is a part of every diet. So I feel so much better now.
Brittany, what do you think about these new faux meat products coming on the market? Do you see more options out there? How do they taste?
I do see a lot of options. I personally don't like this fake meat because it looks too much like real meat. But for a lot of my vegan friends, I see that it's really helped with the transition.
And what is that transition like for your friends? Is it hard for them to get behind your lifestyle, your plant-based lifestyle?
Sometimes it's hard to find restaurants to eat at. So I like to introduce my friends to the different plant-based options. So I will tell them about these different meat-like options.
It sounds like it's going to be a work in progress on your friends. Well, Brittany, thank you so much for calling in and sharing a bit about your situation. Let's go to Stephanie now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I would just like to share, I think there's a lot of perceived misconceptions behind the benefits of plant-based versus animal-based products. I really think the consumer needs to take a closer look at the origin of their meat. If they're buying from, you know, grass-based farms where ruminants are actually being raised as they should, you know, the meat actually has a lot of health benefits. The issue that, you know, we have with all the inflammatory issues because of, you know, conventional meat that we buy off the supermarket, is that the ratio of omega-3s and omega-6 is off, and it spikes a lot of inflammation in our systems because those animals are being fed, you know, high concentrate, you know, corn-based diets, and they're not designed for that. I think people who are on this plant-based type diet really need to be concerned about all the estrogens in soy and the GMOs, you know, that most of those products are made from.
Stephanie, you bring up many good points here, Pranabendu, things that you have touched on a little bit here. But Stephanie's saying, you know, take a look at those grass-fed animals. They do provide benefits.
Yeah, right. So it does. When you have the plant-based benefit, that's the omega-3, and that you can also have it in the different fishes, omega-3. So that is needed for your body, and it comes from that meat and animal sources. So it does not mean that you cannot compensate with that. For example, if you go through the extrusion process, so that means in this technology, you are actually mixing all of that material together in the dry. In this case, you can also add the water amount. So you have option. When you go for the plant-based option, so you have option to compensate this one when you are texturized that protein and that in through the extrusion process. Extrusion is actually very versatile process that you can develop different versatile with a different nutrition content product. So I think that issue can be represented, and that is the valid point that really whatever we are having, we are getting all that nutrients needed for our body. So this way you can represent this way. So when you can change the formulation. So now you see that for having the different options, So we are also doing something in our lab. For example, our food product development class. I'm teaching food processing engineering, food engineering, food unit operation of food processing and food product development. At the part of the food product development labs, we are also trying to make that meat analog. For example, we are trying veggie burger, black bean based
burger. Veggie burgers,
Black bean based soybean. And that time we are trying to manipulate that formulations, that other ingredient, for example, omega-3 or other essential oils, how we can add there in different. So changing the formulations, we can solve this issue.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot on this front in food engineering. Pranabendu, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here.
Pranabendu Mitra is an assistant professor in the Department of Food and Nutrition at UW-Stout. He joined us from our Eau Claire studio, and we've been talking about faux meat products. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Ideas Network. Thank you.